Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
One day, shortly after the arrival of new children in the classroom, the elementary teacher gathers the new children and any other interested students in a circle and begins a story. There was a time long ago when there was nothing here. No classroom, no town, no America, no oceans, no earth, no planets, no stars, no sun, no solar system. Nothing. Can you imagine that? The children's eyes grow wide. The teacher continues, a time of nothing, nothing but darkness and cold. How did all this change so that these things that we see around us just came to be? What could have made all the nothing turn into all these things that we know, all these things I just mentioned? There's a tremendous power in nature, a power that could turn nothing into all these planets and stars and even our Earth. For days afterward, the children are involved in experiments highlighting the natural laws of the universe. For example, they might sprinkle tiny squares of paper on the surface of water and watch as some begin to stick to others, demonstrating the law of attraction. They would go on to learn about gases, liquids, and solids formed as a result of the Big Bang. They begin their own investigations of natural forces and occurrences as the solar system was formed. There are no lists to memorize and no quizzes on the information, but the students are busily absorbed in their work.
This is a snapshot of a Montessori education, taken from the book Montessori, The Science Behind the Genius, by Angelin Stoll Lillard. From a parent's perspective, what should parents know about this kind of education? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest today has had a variety of experiences with Montessori education. Dr. Angelin Stoll Lillard is professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. She has written a recently published book, Montessori, The Science Behind the Genius, in which she explains Montessori education in comparison with and contrast to traditional education. Dr. Lillard has received awards for her work in developmental psychology and is a mother who chose Montessori for her own two daughters, now ages 11 and 13. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Lillard.
Thank you.
First, we need to clarify for us and our listeners, what would you say is the philosophy behind Montessori education?
It's hard to say the philosophy in just a few sentences. It'll come out gradually through our conversation. But I think the really essential philosophy underlying Montessori education is that one can work in harmony with the way that children are, and through working in harmony with them can create an educational system in which they thrive and learn more than they might in a system that works against them.
Can you see the difference in approach when you're in a Montessori classroom?
When you walk into a Montessori classroom, one of the things that will strike you is the children are just busily absorbed in their work, and they're working independently. In primary, they'll often choose to work by themselves, although they can work together. In elementary, they're always working in little groups of three or four, working busily on reports together and creating things together. So that's a real essential difference when you walk in. The teacher is not leading them along in the factory-style approach where the teacher's in charge and making sure that they're all working. The children in a Montessori classroom are working out of an intrinsic motivation to work, not because they're going to get graded and they're being told what to do, but because the classroom has such inspiring and interesting materials and the lessons are so inspiring, the children want to go on and explore things and learn.
So visually, you would see a bunch of activity centers rather than desks in a row and lines facing toward the blackboard kind of thing.
Right. So you walk in, and there will be low shelves all around the room, and it's always very organized and very beautiful. So there'll be maybe some beautiful art reproductions on the walls. It's not at all cluttered. It's very simple. And there will be wooden shelves that are organized in such a way that there'll be, for example, sensorial materials in one place that are to educate the senses. There will be practical life activities in another place I'm describing in a primary classroom. There will be an area for language materials, an area for math, an area for learning geography. And the children will, when they arrive in the morning, decide, what do I want to do today? And one child might decide they want to start with table washing as a 4-year-old or a 3-year-old, and they'll go and they'll take out the table washing equipment and carry it over to a place. And there's a very set way to carry out table washing. It's a very orderly set of steps that the children go through, and they will carry that on.
You know, there are a lot of parents listening who are thinking, table washing, now this is a really good start.
But, but an orderly method to doing it, that would be the surprise, I think, to most people. You give them a bucket, you give them a rag or a sponge, and they do it.
Right.
Montessori doesn't do it that way.
And in Montessori, there's even, you know, a particular way to strike the table. So part of it is teaching children about an ordered way to do things. Part of this is so they learn to function well in society. So you take things out and then you put things back because they need to be there for others to use. And you keep things in order so that people can go and find them easily and take them out easily. But we also know from much research in psychology that people really thrive on order, particularly young children do much better when their lives are ordered. So studies have been done going into children's homes and looking at how well ordered the home is. And homes that are kept in better physical order have children who do better on all kinds of cognitive tests from the Bailey on up. And that's even when you control for parent education, parent income, things that you would expect would be associated with order. So children really thrive on having order. However, you might be thinking to yourself, well, traditional school is very ordered and there's an exact way that you go through things. But people also thrive on having a sense of choice and a sense of control. And Montessori balances these things out by allowing this choice and control at the more macro level where a child arrives and does get to decide what they want to do. Whereas at the micro level, exactly how you use a material, there is a really set way. And there's also research showing that if children are given a material that is supposed to impart a certain bit of knowledge, say an understanding of dimension, and they use the material in some sort of haphazard way, like they're just building blocks with it or building something with it that isn't the way it was intended to be used, that they won't get the underlying abstract understanding.
Now, how do you square that with the work of somebody like John Holt?
There's actually been recent research against the notion of discovery learning. They've shown that when you just give children a bunch of materials that are supposed to impart a scientific concept, if you don't give them any steps to go through in learning it, they don't learn it. They really need to have more guidance. The work showing that children learn more and do better with materials when they just play with them first mostly comes from a particular task called the creative uses task, where a child has to look at an object like a block and say all the different things you could do with a block. Well, children who've played with the blocks have more ideas about what to do, but that makes sense that on that particular task, playing with it would make a difference. It doesn't seem to be the case that when you want children to get something abstract from materials, that playing with it any which way helps. It seems like working with it in a particular set of sequence steps, that kind of work helps children to get the abstract concept underlying it. And Montessori is very tightly structured in that way.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on Montessori education.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Angeline Stoll-Lillard about Montessori education.
If Montessori education is more student development driven, how do parents and teachers know what students are learning and whether they're actually learning the material?
One thing that's so different in Montessori education is that the work is all laid out and easy to see. So children are doing their work on a rug on the floor that they've rolled out or on a large table, and it's with these materials, and a teacher can just walk past and see if a child is using the material correctly and is getting the answers that they should be getting. So it's very easy for teachers to see that. However, what they don't do is step right in at the moment and say, gee, you're doing that wrong. What they'll do is they'll just quietly represent the lesson again later. And there's research showing that kind of open evaluation can actually be a strong disincentive towards doing further work. So there's evidence supporting this Montessori way of correcting. So that's one way that the teachers know, is they just walk by and they can see. Another way is that the children actually come across their own mistakes. Many Montessori materials are set up with what Montessori called control of error. So, for example, there's one material called the wooden cylinders, where this is a material that children use very early in Montessori primary, the 3 to 6 year old classrooms, where there is a wooden rectangle, and inside of this go cylinders, which vary in systematic ways. So there's some that vary in height from shortest to tallest. There's some that vary in width, and there's some that vary in various combinations of height and width. And the child who's taking all these cylinders out, mixing them up, and putting them back in, if they get to the end and there's one that doesn't fit, they know that they made an error. And there are many materials that have that sort of control of error embedded in them. So the child sees their mistake. And they learn through repeated use of this material, because the materials were experimentally designed for children to want to use them more. So Montessori would bring a material into the classroom, would watch the children use the material, and if the children weren't inspired to keep using it, she would take it back home and put it in the dumpster and work on something else that night that she would then bring in the next day. So the materials were carefully designed to be something that children find interesting and that they're inspired to keep using.
Maria Montessori was learning from what children were doing.
Yes, and that is so different from the approach in traditional education. The way that we've structured traditional schools is based on a factory model and a behaviorist model of the child. And this comes from the early 1900s, when we were establishing mass public schools in this country. And at the time, it was the age of efficiency. So if you've read Cheaper by the Dozen, we know Frank Gilworth was a real person who was going around with his wife and lecturing to industries around the world about how to be more efficient. Well, schools are set up in that same spirit. So we have the platoon or Gary plan, where children change classrooms every 50 minutes. That was done in order to use the space more efficiently. So the bell rings and you stop teaching at that moment, whether children are ready or not. That's how you run things efficiently in this factory system. And that's not a good model for learning. You know, children aren't just cogs in a wheel, and we don't want them all to come out in exactly the same way as a factory is designed for them to come out. So that's not a very good model for children. And the second poor model is the behaviorist model of the child, which is this empty vessel model that you can dump information into children and then they can regurgitate it on multiple choice tests, and that's what learning is. And I think that these multiple choice tests that are coming in, the No Child Left Behind testing movement, actually encourage that. They encourage these precise answers to questions and not the deeper conceptual learning. And there's lots of research showing that when people learn something for a multiple choice test, they don't get the deeper underlying concepts and they forget the information very quickly. So it's not the kind of learning that we want. And yet schools were set up for that kind of learning, for this behaviorist style. I give you the information, you regurgitate it. In Montessori education, there's deep processing. There aren't any tests to take. It's really about learning and getting deep conceptual concepts, coming to understand the world and its interconnections.
Do teachers make notes about individual children?
Yes, they make note of individual children. In the primary classroom, the teachers are often able to just keep everything in their heads. By elementary, there are so many lessons and so many materials that they'll often have a chart or something in a closet where they will keep track of where each child is and the sequence of lessons. When Montessori teachers do their training, the Association Montessori International is the organization that Montessori set up to carry on her work. And I'm going to describe their training because it's the most true to her way of doing Montessori. It's very important whenever I talk about this to bear in mind that anybody can use the term Montessori and apply it to their schools. It's not a trademark term. So anybody can hang up a shingle outside that says this is a Montessori school. They don't have to be following good Montessori practices at all to do that. The Association Montessori International certifies schools in the United States which do follow her practices more closely. And they train teachers, and their training is a full 9-month training course. And during that training, teachers learn a set of lessons to give and how to use the materials. Some of the materials are purchased, other materials the teachers make during the course of their training. But over these 9 months, they learn Montessori theory, but they also learn all of the lessons, and they practice the lessons on each other, and then they go and they practice them on children. So they learn how to give them in a very captivating way. So all of these lessons add up to being what people in Montessori don't like to use the word, but we would call a curriculum. So in each area, there's really a set of steps through which children go and a sequence of lessons. So there's a sequence of geometry lessons, a sequence of sensorial lessons. These lessons are all tightly interwoven. They're tightly interconnected. One thing that's unique about Montessori education is that she made up the entire curriculum from birth through age 12. So there's one person who's really a genius, very broad-minded woman. You know, she started out in engineering and math and then decided to become a physician. And if you look at her early papers, they're on all kinds of things from bronchial asthma on up. So she had a very broad mind. And she made up all of these lessons and all of these materials with an eye to what else was going on for the child before and after and across the curriculum. And that's really unique. If you compare it to, say, a fourth grader who has a textbook that they're using for science, it's going to have nothing to do with the textbook that they're using for history or the textbook that they used 2 years ago for science very often, especially since school districts change curricula so much. In Montessori, it's one curriculum. It's used in all the schools worldwide, and the teachers are given these lessons in their training. So in contrast, teachers who go to traditional schools of education and then are teaching in the schools, they need to make up all their lessons. And then when you change textbooks, they have to make them up again. So they're spending a lot of time making up lessons. In Montessori, the teachers are given the lessons, so they get to focus on the individual children and their interests and really watch how that child is taking this lesson and think about how they can help that child to connect to the material and learn more.
Having been in Montessori classrooms, I have to say that the materials are spectacularly appealing. And I can see where it would be very exciting to be a teacher who's learning the Montessori program and how to teach the lessons, because I wanted to get my hands on all those different materials and sit down and learn them with the kids. I think they're beautiful. But I also think there's a special appeal to them in that they're only in the classroom. The children don't take them home. So at home, they play with entirely different kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I think there's a big plus to that.
Yes.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on Montessori education.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $10 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Angeline Lillard, author of Montessori, The Science Behind the Genius, about Montessori education.
You said that Montessori education stops basically at age 12. So you could have a child going from the beginning of his or her preschool experience through age 12, but then they have to go somewhere else. How do these children adapt to a more standard situation?
The program is really developed through age 12, but she did have some ideas and wrote some essays about adolescence, and those are being incorporated more and more. So more and more often you're seeing Montessori schools that have middle schools, and even high schools are now starting to appear. So how do they adapt? Well, unfortunately, there's very little research on this. Anecdotally, we know that they adapt very, very well. They often end up being the leaders in their schools. They're interested in learning. They're curious. They haven't had their desire to learn extinguished. And because there's so much collaboration and working together in elementary, they're much better at working with others in teams. And so they are often the leaders. I'd also like to point out that the founders of Google and the founder of Amazon have all publicly credited some of their success in life to their Montessori educations.
And their Montessori schools are probably right now getting in touch with them for donations.
Having just read your book, Montessori, The Science Behind the Genius, I'm going to ask you if you would just sort of summarize for us the 8 basic principles of a Montessori education.
I talk about 8 basic principles of Montessori education, which I see having strong support in psychology research. These aren't the same 8 that somebody else might pick out if they wanted to talk about what Montessori is. But I chose these 8 because there's a large body of psychology research speaking to them. The first principle is that we think better when our cognition is aligned in some way with our movement. So in Montessori education, there's movement all over the place, and the movement is very much in line with what the children are thinking. So they're moving in ways that are consistent with what they're thinking about, and psychology research has shown us that you think best when you're moving in that way. Second principle is that we learn best and we do best in general in life, so we have a better sense of well-being when we have more of a sense of choice and control over our environments. We learn best when we're interested in what we're learning about. We also fare best when we are not getting extrinsic rewards for what we do. And this is one that often really surprises people. But there is ample research to show that if somebody's already interested in doing things, they're already interested in some activity, and you proceed to tell them you're going to reward them for doing that activity, and then they do it, and then you give them the reward, their subsequent interest in the activity declines. They're less interested in doing it, and they also don't do it as well when they know they're going to get some sort of reward or evaluation.
All you parents who are thinking of paying or giving some kind of reward for good report cards, here it is. You don't have to do this.
Yeah. No, and even just the fact of having report cards, I mean, that's an expected reward for doing well in school, is that A. And what happens is then once children get the C, then they lose all interest because the reward has been withdrawn. And there is research showing that children's motivation to learn in traditional schools declines every year that they're in traditional schools. There are lots of reasons for it, I think, the lack of choice, the lack of interest, but I think the extrinsic rewards may be one of them. A fifth principle is that children learn very well socially, that they can learn very well from each other, particularly in elementary. And this is where our school system is so crazy. We say that in kindergarten, that's when they need to learn social things, so we have them do lots of things together. And then they get to elementary and we say, okay, now it's time to learn individually. You sit in separate desks. It's illegal to help each other with homework or on tests. You know, you have to be independent and individual. And yet we know as psychology researchers that young children like parallel play. Yes, they like to play together, but it's in elementary that they become really interested in their peers. And in adolescence, they don't even want to go home anymore. They just want to be with their friends. And so the system in traditional schools is set up against how children fare well.
And it's interesting. And then when we get to be corporate management, we have to pay people to come in to tell us how to play nicely with everybody else.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, in Montessori, it goes the way that children naturally are. They're able to work together in primary, but they don't choose to so much. In elementary, they're working together, as I said, all the time, and they really seem to learn how to work together very well. So that's a fifth principle. Then a sixth one is that we learn best when we understand the meaning of what it is that we're learning. That's an obvious one to most of us, but so much of what you learn as you go through school seems disembodied. It doesn't seem related to other things. As I said, in Montessori, the curriculum is highly interconnected, and there's a lot of attention to children understanding how it relates to what's going on in the outside world. A seventh principle is that we know in psychology that particular ways of interacting with children by parents and teachers and the like are associated with better child outcomes. And Montessori consciously directed teachers about how to interact with children, and it's very much in line with that research. And finally, the eighth principle is order, and the children fare best in an organized and orderly environment.
Dr. Lillard, in addition to your book, Montessori, The Science Behind the Genius, what other resources would you recommend for parents or others interested in learning more about Montessori education?
I would recommend that they first go and look at a well-functioning Montessori school. As I said, they're not all well-functioning. In the back of my book, I have suggestions for things to look for to see a good-functioning Montessori classroom, like the children deeply concentrating on their work. If it's an elementary classroom, you don't want to see any worksheets out. You want to see children that are absorbed, concentrating, and empathetic towards each other. That's a signal of a good Montessori classroom.
Before somebody goes to visit a Montessori school, is there some kind of seal of approval that they can look for to see whether it's worth their while to even spend the time?
Yes. Not all good Montessori schools have bothered to seek for the seal of approval, but the Association Montessori International, which Montessori founded to carry on her work, in the United States certifies Montessori schools which have teachers who are well-trained and who in basic ways are complying with Montessori principles. So one place one can go is the Association Montessori International's website, where they can find schools that are certified. They also, on all of the Montessori websites, often have recommended readings. One of Montessori's own books that is particularly good is The Absorbent Mind. And another resource, people often point to my mother's own books on this. My mother was deeply involved in Montessori and still is from the early 1960s, which is part of how I know it so well. Her name is Paula Polk Lillard, and she has a book called Montessori Today, which describes the elementary curriculum in great detail. And she also has a book with my sister, Lynn Jessen, about Montessori in the toddler years, really from birth to age 3, and another book, Montessori, The Modern Approach, which talks about a Montessori in primary more. So her books are often the ones that are on these websites.
This is a family business.
This is a family business. And it may make one skeptical that I would be writing this book coming from such a family. However, I think it's important to point out, I came at this with a very scientific approach, and there was a time when I was sure that although Montessori surely had its strengths, certainly other school systems do too, and the best educational system would combine the strengths of different systems. And the conclusion that I came to in doing the research for the book and reading Montessori's writings and thinking about psychology research is that she was really right on all of her major points, and that other school systems aren't, that other approaches really do have some strengths, it's true, but not strengths beyond hers, and they have problems that Montessori doesn't have.
Well, you have certainly given us a whole lot to think about, and we are just so glad to have been able to have this conversation. So, Dr. Angeline Lillard, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Dr. Lillard's book, Montessori, The Science Behind the Genius. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show number 280. Spell anything that's not obvious, please. It really is a help to us. Tell us if you can what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Dr. Lillard's book, Montessori, The Science Behind the Genius, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents Perspective, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. You can listen to Parents Perspective, in addition to on the radio stations you're used to, via podcast anytime. Click Listen to Podcast on our website and then follow the instructions. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.